We are here today with Patricia Hare-Leahy, a professor of history emerita at the Waston Institute and the History Department. So our first question is about Sochi. It was the first Olympics to be held in Russia since the Soviet Union hosted the 1980 Summer Olympics in Moscow. Could you help us understand in more depth what this means for Russia?
The fact that the Olympics were held in Russia, of course, was a great boon, a feather in the cap of Russia in general, and Putin in particular. He argued very persuasively to have it held in Sochi, despite people's doubts, first in a subtropical area and so close to scenes of violence, you know, with the various wars against Chechnya. But he did it with some minor kind of failings along the way. But on the whole, I think it was a triumph, and he wanted to show the modernity. And it's very characteristic of Russian leaders to want monumental, grand projects. The Stalin buildings, for example, are huge, and to suggest power. And the Soviets wanted to use the tundra to grow potatoes and put electric light and then turn rivers around. They had always these monumental plans. So the idea of choosing what appeared to be such an unsuitable place for Winter Olympics would boggle the mind of most people, but it's kind of in the Russian tradition, and Putin had his own agenda for wanting it there.
In which way has Sochi shined a new light on the ongoing protests against the Russian government, most notably ones from the Pussy Riot?
Yes, the Pussy Riot people that couldn't, if you wanted to stage a more emblematic scene of brutality and absolutely randomly meted justice or so-called punishment meted out simply for photographing film. They were singing and being photographed for a documentary and should give an offense to no one, no matter what the lyrics were. And they were dressed, they were stark naked. There was no reason for any punishment, much less such brutal horse-whipping by a Cossack. Certainly shines a light on the failings of the system today.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. The repercussions of what happened in Ukraine last Saturday, could you talk to us a little bit more about what that means for the geopolitical scene in Eastern Europe?
Oh, at this point, it's in the air. It's almost anyone's guess. You can envision a whole series of scenarios. One that the Ukrainian leaders in the parliament at present managed to secure financial aid, whether from the EU or from the IMF or elsewhere, other than Russia, and stabilize a little bit of its financial and fiscal future and elect a new president and then go on from there. That would be the best of all possible worlds. On the other end of the spectrum, I can easily envision Russia invading the Crimea on the pretense of protecting the citizens of that area. They're already, or Medvedev, Dmitry Medvedev, has already started to speak about action against Russian citizens whose rights have to be protected. And they began speaking of the rights of Russians in Abkhazia when they invaded Georgia. So they're setting up the scenario to make it plausible, or hope to make it plausible in the eyes of the world, that they're justified in marching into this area that had been part of Russia until 1954. So what the reaction would be to this naked aggression on the part of the West, or even the NATO countries that now pretty much surround Russia, is very difficult to imagine just how extensive and dangerous a situation that might be. Or it could be, you know, some other kind of intermediary. The Russians hike up the price of gas or even turn off the gas on Ukrainians and demand immediate payment of their arrears and their debts. They could put a lot of financial screws on Ukraine short of invading them. It's difficult for me, at any rate, to hypothesize about Russian sympathy in keeping a healthy Ukraine that's not under their influence, being somewhat pessimistic. cautiously prudent at this point.
Well, we wait to see what happens there.
Yes, it's just too fluid and volatile at this point. It's like waiting for the other shoe to fall. You know, Putin himself has not said anything since the leader has fled. Since he disappeared, he has made no announcement of what Russia's attitude is. But sent Medvedev, as I said, to kind of prepare the scene for helping Russian nationals. Are they really just even ethnic Russians?
Going back to Russia a little bit, where you changed topics, mm-hmm. Your book titled Vodka, A Global History.
Yes.
How does, in your study of vodka, the recent protests from gay communities against Russian vodka, what implications does that have on a historical importance of vodka in the Russian tradition?
Yeah, so that's an interesting question, because the fact that gays, or some gays, some LGBTs, react in this way, that when they thought they wanted to lash back at Russia for these absurd anti-gay laws enacted last June, the first thing they thought of was vodka. And so they didn't say, you know, we're not going to eat sausages or no more pickles. It was vodka. Both because it is a segment of the population tends to favor vodka over some of them, let's say, bourbon or scotch. So it's a commodity they're familiar with, and if they want to punish Russia, they go for the vodka. Others wanted to, as you know, boycott the Olympics altogether. So it depends on, you know, how you think that Russia could be punished the best. And for kind of the same reasons, in a way, that's why I chose to study vodka, because it's so revealing, not only of Russian culture, which is pretty obvious, but also politics and economics, and the demography, the health, public health, and art, literature. Almost every aspect of Russian history has vodka in part of Russian history. So I find it a useful latch.
So do you have any other working projects, things that you're interested in right now at the moment?
Yes, well, I have a continuing interest in the history of the city of Odessa, which, if all goes well for Putin and he does invade Crimea, may become a Russian city again. But at any rate, it's Ukrainian, at least territorially. It's a Ukrainian city right now. So I've stopped writing books about Odessa, but I continue to write articles about Odessa. I continue to write about vodka in the sense of the public health issue of the high death rates among young men. In other words, I'm interested in demography. That's the downside of vodka. And thirdly, especially since I'm here in the Institute of International Studies, I'm writing a biography of an American diplomat who was in Russia. It's in the middle of the 19th century. He served in 8 other countries besides Russia. So I'm following his career through these 9 countries in the context of American foreign relations with Europe in that period.
Great. Thank you so much for the interview today. It was wonderful meeting you.